Good morning.
Morning.
Calling to order the Ag and Food Finance and Policy Division. We do have a full agenda and a full house, so that's really good. So the clerk will note the roll, and we have minutes from February 27th. Representative Brandt.
Yep, Madam Chair, I move the minutes from the February 27th meeting.
Those are in your packets. Anyone have any questions, discussion, additions? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. The motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. We have a few bills on our calendar today, but we also have, as you've noted, certainly a full house of Blue Jackets. So we're pretty excited today. It's FFA Day at the Capitol. So we always love to see the Blue Jackets. We always love to welcome our students. We know that the future is bright because we have you come before the committee. We listen. I mean, we've done this. Representative Hamilton has done this. It's always a great day. It brings a smile to our faces. So we're happy to have you here. And I'm just going to ask, we've got a couple of officers that are going to come down. So I believe we have Nick and Savannah that will be coming forward to greet us this morning. So greetings to you. Welcome to the committee. Some of us were able to go to your reception last evening, and we appreciate that you invited us and that you're here today. So welcome to the committee. Now let whoever wants to start begin.
Good morning, Chair Poppy, members of the committee. My name is Nick, like she said. I went to Martin County West Junior Senior High School in Sherburn, Minnesota. And beside me is my fellow state officer teammate, Savannah Onnerud, and she went to Morris area. So on behalf of the Minnesota FFA Association, I want to thank you for the support that you give us today. And as you can see, we have a ton of our members from Minnesota here. So a couple of our members I see over here have been participating in our ag policy experience. So 30 to 40 members have been learning about the legislative process on the Capitol Hill and learning about how they can have an influence on agricultural policy. And a couple other members to my left over here, I can see, we have over 200 members here today celebrating FFA Day at the Capitol, and they are from chapters from all over the state, from Fairmont, Minnesota to Albany, and even up north by Fertile Beltrami, so all over the state. A little bit about FFA, if you aren't familiar with it, FFA is a major piece of agricultural education. So in an FFA member's lifetime, they are sitting in an agriculture classroom, learning about careers in agriculture and everything they should be knowing about agriculture. And then the second piece of agricultural education is the FFA part of it. So they're participating in contests, and they're going to leadership events, going to conferences in the summer to learn more about leadership. And then the final piece is a supervised agricultural experience. So they're applying their skills from the classroom to a hands-on experience. So we really value the hands-on and experiential learning portion of agriculture. So the mission of FFA is to promote premier leadership, personal growth, and career success. And a piece that I really want to highlight this morning is our career success. So about my story, one of my favorite contests in FFA was the prepared public speaking event. So I gave a speech on food safety and about food waste. So where is our food waste going, and how do we solve that issue to make sure that we're being the safest and most environmentally sustainable with our food systems? And it inspired me to take up a career in agricultural communications to keep spreading the message of agriculture and how we can improve in the agricultural field and further bridge that gap between the urban and rural and make sure that agriculture is talked about, I suppose. Another story about career readiness is my cousin, actually. So he's a year older than me, and he goes to college at Minnesota West. And in one of his contests, he participated in the agricultural mechanic CDE, and he learned how to do welds as a contest. And so he found an interest in welding, and at Minnesota West, he studies welding and has actually been recruited by AGCO, an ag manufacturing company in Jackson. And he found another career path through FFA and through agricultural education. So we are always preparing our members for careers in agriculture and as well as in food, natural resource, and environmental sciences systems.
Chair Poppy, members of the committee, FFA's goal is to include all individuals, whether you reside in the rural or urban areas. But specifically, we really want to try out and reach and provide opportunities in the urban areas. And for an example, one opportunity that I had to participate in is Urban Ag Day. And this is where my FFA chapter was able to reach about 1,500 third through fifth graders and help engage them where their food comes from. This is something that I take pride in, and it's important for us to do this because something that we all have in common is that we all need to eat. Also, agriculture is a career and technical education program, and CTE is important to everyone. Whether you are here in the urban area, you can be a leader in the Fortune 500 companies such as Cargill or CHS or Land O'Lakes. We can also be a leader in traditional agriculture and small businesses as well. Another way that we try to connect members and individuals is through just our common goal of engaging and telling our story of agriculture. Continued support would help us share our story and expand our engagements with students. Truly investing in the lives of students today helps create leaders for tomorrow, and that's something that's one of FFA's goals. So we thank you so much for the invitation and our time and having us here today. And we are totally ready to answer any questions that you may have for us.
That's great to hear. Thank you for the presentation this morning. Thank you for being here, all of the students. It's always good to have such a great room full that are interested in what we're doing, and because we're always interested in what you're doing. So thank you for being leaders in FFA. Is there any committee members that have questions or comments? Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I've said this before. You know, you should be extremely proud, all of you. You know, it doesn't matter whether you're a rural member or a urban member, male, female, black, brown, or white, you're the best and the brightest the state has to offer. So thank you so much for your testimony. It's always great to see you.
Thank you. And Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifiers. When I was a young girl, jumping out of the hayloft into piles of loose hay, I never expected myself to be a legislator. So please don't forget about that path, too. We would love to have your skills and talents here at the Capitol as well. Thank you.
Absolutely. All right. I don't see any other comments. Thank you so very much. Enjoy your day. I know you have visits with all sorts of legislators probably planned. And again, we appreciate that you came before us today, and we appreciate all that you do. So congratulations on being state officers as well. Thank you. So next we're going to, so we have a couple of bills on the calendar. The first one is the County Ag Society County Fair bill. We did have the amendment, there is an amendment to it. It was posted in early afternoon. I just wanted to ask Representative Hamilton to put you on the spot. We knew that this amendment was coming, but it did not meet the 24-hour rule, and are you okay with us pursuing the amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you.
Thank you, and I apologize I didn't get a chance to connect with you. So, Representative Brand, you're here before us, and if you have a motion to make, please.
Yep, I move that House File 3767 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes.
That is true, it is going to taxes, and so now there's an author's amendment. Representative Brand, would you move that amendment?
I move the A1 amendment, please.
Okay, and so could you just describe briefly the bill and the amendment?
Certainly. So the bill itself kind of touches on some legislation that was enacted last year, allowing agriculture or county agriculture societies that are not required to collect or remit sales tax for sales that occur at the county fair. You might remember that from last year. Current law provides that if the society owns the fairgrounds, it must use the savings to maintain or better society-owned fairground buildings and facilities. If a society does not own the fairgrounds, it must transfer the money to the fairgrounds owner. In this case, several of them are owned by a county who must use it for the same purposes. So essentially, this legislation kind of cleans up the legislation that was passed last year. The amendment itself is kind of a technical change. It inserts on page 1, line 11, maintain the fairgrounds or before maintain. And also, I guess, you know, it's just worth reiterating, it removes some language about the transfer of money depending on who owns what.
Okay, so any questions or discussion to the amendment at this point? Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor of the H3767A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So now before us is the bill as amended.
Absolutely. And I would just like to turn over the show to AJ, and I think AJ has a testifier as well, and kind of talk a little bit more about the bill and why it's necessary.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Doerr and Mr. Carlson. So Mr. Doerr, we'll begin with you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Andrew Doerr, and I'm here today representing the Minnesota Federation of County Fairs. Not a lot to add. Representative Brand did a great job describing the bill. We first want to thank the legislature for the sales tax exemption that was passed in the tax bill last year. It's been incredibly successful in helping our county ag societies improve the fairgrounds around the state. But just a little bit of background, when we passed the sales tax exemption, and again, as Representative Brand said, it's for sales made by a county ag society during the days of the county fair. And those typically fall into four different categories. It's admissions to the fair itself, parking, admissions to grandstand events, and there are some county ag societies that have sell things like concessions and things like that. The exemption does not apply to anybody that's not a county ag society, whether it's the carnival or anybody else that's making sales at the fair. And it also doesn't apply for sales that are made by the ag society outside the days of the fair. And there are some of those. They're typically like things like storage or renting up the space and things like that. And as was mentioned, this is really companion language to the exemption that's in tax statute. And where this language came from, it's when the legislature granted the sales tax exemption, it was a clear message to us that it was granted but the purpose of improving, expanding, and maintaining fairgrounds. And we certainly agreed with that and took that to heart. So that's where this language came from. And in the instances, it's roughly half and half. About half the fairgrounds in the state are owned by county ag societies. And in that instance, there really is no issue. But in about the other half, it's usually by the county itself. There are a couple of, I think there's at least one that's owned by a city, and there's actually one up in Chisholm near Representative Eklund's district, not in but near, that's actually on state land. And in that instance, most of the time it's still working okay. And as Mr. Carlson, he's from Itasca County, will talk about it. The relationship with the county is fine, but it's both sides are thinking it's kind of inefficient to send it there just to wait to send it back. But there have actually been a couple of instances as well where the money is the savings is going, and I'll just say that the Ag Society is not realizing the benefit of the law that was passed last year. So so that's why we're here today. And unless there's any questions, I'll turn it over to Mr. Carlson.
Okay, welcome to the committee, Mr. Carlson.
Well, good morning, and Madam Chair and committee members, Brian Carlson, Itasca County, out of Grand Rapids. I'm also a member of the State Minnesota Federation of County Fairs. And I just wanted to highlight, I made a call around after talking with AJ to see what some of the other fairs did with the money that they received this past year. And most of them, of course, are repairs, upgrades. We've got one fair that has a sump pump that went out, and they had major work to do on repairing that and clearing out an area that they had. In our particular fair, we had a lot of electrical work. Some of it hasn't been done since 65, and we noticed in one of our junction boxes that it was overheating, and the box was actually attached to a wooden building, and somebody noticed it this summer, so that was the first thing we took down, and we got that taken care of right away. So we certainly appreciate this. It is going back into the fairgrounds. I will attest to that, and really appreciate you guys supporting this. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any others you'd like to testify for or against the bill? I don't see anyone else coming down. Any member questions? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Doerr, you may have answered this question, but I'm just thinking, are there any fairground properties that are owned privately in the state?
Mr. Doerr.
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, I do not believe so. I'll check, but I've been working for, maybe Mr. Carlson, do you know?
I don't believe so.
I don't believe so, but I'll check.
Thank you. Any other questions? All right, seeing none. Don't see any further discussion. Representative Brand, so would you like to renew your motion?
Yes, I'd like to renew my motion that House File 3767, as amended, be recommended and referred to the Committee on Taxes.
All right, that motion is before us. All in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. The motion prevails. Good luck in taxes.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. So next we'll have House File 3799. And I will, we'll be doing some switching here, so Representative Brand will take over and I'll come to the table.
Chair Poppy, would you like to move your bill?
I would. I move that House File 3799 be recommended to be placed on the General Register.
Okay. Present your bill and introduce your witnesses.
Absolutely. Thank you. This is a bill that refers to MAILC, which is the Minnesota Agricultural Education Leadership Council, but it's currently listed as the Minnesota Agriculture Education Leadership Council. So that's one of the changes that we have in this bill, is to update the language. And as you heard, as we heard from Nick especially, he was talking about agricultural instead of agriculture. So part of what we're doing is just needing to update the information that we have in the bill. And that's what we're going to do today. So I'm going to ask my testifier, Sarah Dornink, who is the director of the MAILC Council, to provide some testimony.
Please state your name and go ahead and provide the testimony.
Thank you, Chair Brand, members of the committee. My name is Sarah Dornick, Executive Director for the Minnesota Agricultural Education Leadership Council, or MAILC. MAILC is a 17-member legislative council that works to promote and expand agricultural education across the state. Our office is housed at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities, and myself is as the program, or as the executive director, and Carrie Schwab is our program coordinator. Today we are asking for the committee support of House File 3799, which provides modifications to the MAILC's board membership as well as some terminology changes. This bill makes two specific membership changes. The first proposed change is modifying the representation from the University of Minnesota Agricultural Education Program. In 1997, the University of Minnesota Twin Cities was the only institution preparing agriculture teachers for licensure. However, since then, both the University of Minnesota Crookston and Southwest Minnesota State University of Marshall have started programs. This language will provide inclusive representation while having generic language to add or eliminate licensure programs from the rotation as they are established or closed. Our plan is to make this a two-year rotating appointment between any institution that trains agriculture teachers. The two-year term is similar to some of the other positions we have on the board. The second membership change eliminates the Minnesota Private College Council and lowers the board membership to 16 members. The Private College Council was not part of the original statute, and however, this position was added in 2007 by a legislator with the hopes that the colleges on the Private College Council would become more engaged in agricultural education. In the 12 years of this appointment, no person has attended a MAILC board meeting. Finally, the bill has a technical change that replaces the term agriculture education with agricultural education throughout. This change is very small, but is more accurate with current practice and in line with many of the national organizations, such as the National Council on Agricultural Education, National Association of Agricultural Educators, and the American Association of Agricultural Educators. These modifications will help MAILC more accurately reflect the changes in agricultural education since 1997. Thank you for the time and consideration of this bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions about MAILC or the bill at this time.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else that would like to testify for or against the bill? All right, seeing no one, we'll go on to questions. Does any member wish to provide a question? No questions either. Okay, well, seeing no further discussion, Representative Poppy, why don't you renew your motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I'd like to renew my motion that House File 3799 be recommended to be placed on the General Register.
All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? House File 3799 is now off to the General Register. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So we're at the point where we're going to have the Minnesota Department of Agriculture bio-incentives report and the annual biodiesel report. Mr. Bob Patton is the supervisor in the Energy and Environment section of Agriculture Marketing and Development Division, and he will come forward to provide some information, and those are in your packet as well. So welcome to the committee, Mr. Patton.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Bob Patton, as the chair mentioned. Bob Patton of the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. I'm the Energy and Environment Supervisor in the Agricultural Marketing and Development Division. And before I begin, I just have to say I wish I had half the poise that the speakers of the FFA, from the FFA had today. That's really inspiring and reassuring. Reports are listed bioincentives and biodiesel, but my slides begin with biodiesel, so if you don't mind, I'm going to present on that. And I'm going to give just a very quick background. I know I need to be very brief overall, but there's some helpful background on biodiesel that I wanted to explain. The first thing is having to do with diesel fuel and characteristics of diesel fuel. There are three different classes of diesel fuel that have to do with the viscosity or the ability of the fuel to flow. And the diesel fuel we're all most familiar with, that's in our vehicles and trucks and buses and so forth, is number two diesel fuel, which is a middle grade in terms of the viscosity. Because all diesel fuel in cold weather has a tendency to gel, and that can plug up filters and so forth, and obviously that's not a good thing when you're for the vehicle. There is number one diesel that is a less viscous fuel that is often blended in the winter with number two diesel in cold weather situations. I think sometimes it's more expensive, but it's used judiciously. And then there's number four diesel, which we don't have to really talk about because it's not having to do with vehicles. One of the things also to note is that there is an international standard for diesel fuel. The ASTM International establishes standards for all sorts of things, including diesel fuel. And it's important to note that standard for diesel fuel includes up to 5% biodiesel. Biodiesel, as the definition, which is on this slide, tells you, is a renewable biodegradable fuel. It's made from plant and animal oils and fats, and there is an ASTM specification also for 100% biodiesel as a blend stock. There are some characteristics before I leave that slide. Biodiesel is a cleaner fuel than petroleum diesel. It has there are less particulate emissions from it. Also, it has qualities of providing lubrication to the engine. It's called lubricity, which is really important because with the ultra-low sulfur fuel of today, which is good for air quality, there's less lubricity in the fuel because of that, and biodiesel helps restore that. There is a tendency of 100% biodiesel to gel a little bit more easily than regular diesel fuel. And so you'll see, and when I talk about the mandate, there is a switch over of fuels from the higher content level of biodiesel to a lower for the winter. So I'm going to go through just a quick timeline of the biodiesel mandate. We were the first state in the nation to adopt a biodiesel content standard in 2002, and that standard was implemented in 2005. The law was changed in 2008 to set new content levels, 5%, 10%, and 20%, and you'll see that the content levels for B10 and B20 are for warm weather only, and then the standard reverts to 5% or B5 for the warm weather months. And there are a number of exceptions in the law for other types of uses. B10 and B20 require, they're really conditional upon approval by the agencies, MDA, the Department of Commerce, and the Pollution Control Agency. And so there are some standards, conditions that need to be met for those, or that needed to be met for those two levels to be implemented. And then there's a consultation with a biodiesel task force, which is a group convened by the department. And there's a notice requirement. There are also some substantial safeguards or off-ramps, we like to call them, in the statute. One I'll note that did come into play is the Department of Commerce can grant a temporarily suspend the waiver if there are issues with supply and or quality, and that did occur when B20 was initially implemented. So the B5 mandate was implemented in 2009. The B10 mandate was implemented in 2014, and you'll notice that that's 2 years after the statutory date. The reason for that was that there were those conditions I mentioned earlier. The supply wasn't in place at that in 2012, and so the implementation of the mandate was delayed until 2014, when the production had increased. And then the B20 mandate was implemented on time on May 1st of 2018. I mentioned the temporary suspension. There was a supply disruption right after the implementation of B20, and so that provision did kick in, and there was, I believe, a month suspension of the mandate, and then it went back into place. Also, during the legislative session of 2018, there was concern raised. The date of switchover from B5 to B20 is April 1st in the statute, and it was April 1st in the statute, and there was concern that April can still be a cold month. And so there was a change to allow ramp-up time. So currently the mandate goes to B10 on April 1st for a month, and then it goes up to April 15th, then it goes up to B20. And the other thing the legislation did is it removed a sunset date for B1 for use of number one diesel in the winter. We're required to also discuss price factors, and one of the things we do is discuss factors that go into the price, important parts of that, which are kind of complex, but is the is federal policy. The renewable fuel standard essentially creates a market for what are called RINs, which are renewable identification numbers that are associated with gallons of biofuel. And yet there is also a biodiesel blender tax credit of $1 a gallon. And both of those work to effectively reduce the cost of biodiesel for blenders and really make the cost of biodiesel equivalent to and sometimes lower than the cost of diesel fuel. We also talk about supply. In the report, as you can see, there are 84 million gallons per year of that permitted capacity, and that capacity allowed when we did the biodiesel mandate allowed us to the commissioners to make the finding that 50% of the production. Of the demand could be satisfied by production in Minnesota. There's a discussion of the impacts of the biodiesel mandate on supply and production, and there's really no way to draw a cause and effect relationship of the mandate to supply and production, but according to a 2017 report that the agency did, 2005 production was 16 million gallons, and by 2016 it reached 74 million gallons of production capacity. So that concludes what I intended to present on the biodiesel report. I'm happy to stand for questions before I move to bioincentive.
I don't see any questions at this point, so you can go ahead to the next part.
Very good. Let's see. I should get my glasses on. All right, on the bioincentive program, the bioincentive program was the result of 2015 legislation, and it creates a production incentive program that works similarly to the ethanol production incentive program that previously existed. It is a production incentive for advanced biofuels, renewable chemicals, and biomass thermal energy. And so there are a number of requirements that production facilities need to meet to become eligible. They need to be producing before 2025. They need to meet minimum production levels. They importantly need to use renewable biomass from either agricultural or forestry sources or the organic portion of solid waste. They must source 80% of their biomass from Minnesota. There's an exception for border facilities. There are harvesting requirements for agriculture and forestry cellulosic biomass in the statute that are meant to protect natural resources and the environment. It works by reimbursement rates that are by millions of British thermal units, a measure of a unit of energy for advanced biofuels and for biomass thermal energy, and then for renewable chemicals, it's a payment per pound. There are maximums set in the statute that are by either MMBTU or by pounds, and that translates to dollars when you add up the maximum amounts that can be paid, it's over $72 million that potentially could be paid out. And there are also maximum amounts for the per facility. Appropriations come from the Agri account, and the initial appropriation was $500,000, went up to $1.5 million in the second year, and up until through 2019, the appropriation was increased to $2.5 million for the current fiscal year and the following fiscal year. The pattern of claims, as can be expected, started off slow. We had one claim in fiscal year 2017, no claims in fiscal year 16, and then we had two claims in fiscal year 18. We had six in 2019 and then nine in the current fiscal year, the first two quarters of this fiscal year. As you can see, the amounts of claims exceeded the amount of money that was available in Agri for it, that was appropriated for it, by almost $27,000 in fiscal year 19. At that time, the statute called for it was a first come first served payment. So the last producer that came in the door was shorted $27,000. The statute was changed last year to a pro rata. So as you can see on the last line there, we are now out of money for the fiscal year, and we were short by about $1 million, which was, so the shortage was prorated among the nine producers that made claims. And that concludes that presentation, and happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Patton. Are there any questions? Thank you. The information, obviously, we have it here in the PowerPoint, but we have additional information in the packet, so people can feel free to read and digest and then ask further questions of you if they so choose.
Happy to answer them.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Patton.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
Appreciate that.
Chair Poppy, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you. This is House File 3699, and I would move that House File 3699 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce.
Okay. Present the bill and introduce your witnesses, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 3699 amends the current 10% biofuel content standard and increases it to 15%. Minnesota has required biofuel blends for 20 years. With the passage of House File 3699, Minnesota will become the first state in the nation to set a higher standard. As a refresher, Minnesota was the first state in the nation to require ethanol-blended fuels in 1997. From 1997 to 2003, Minnesota law effectively required a 7.7% ethanol blend. In 2003, Minnesota policy expanded the statewide ethanol standard to 10%. In 2019, the federal government issued a federal regulation enabling a higher blend of biofuel to be sold year-round for 2001 or newer vehicles. We believe it's time for Minnesota to increase our biofuel standard to match federal regulations and to advance Minnesota's biofuel leadership by increasing to 15%. House File 3699 is good for farmers. Minnesota can easily meet a 5% increase in the biofuel standard with existing in-state production capacity. Minnesota currently produces 1.27 billion gallons of ethanol each year. Approximately 25% of current production is consumed in-state. The other 75% is exported. Ethanol production uses only the starch in the grain.
The remaining fat and fiber are used as high-protein animal feed. These feed co-products are eaten by cattle, hogs, poultry, and even fish. House File 3699 is good for consumers. The higher blend of biofuel provides consumers higher octane, lower cost, and reduced tailpipe emissions. According to the U.S. Departments of Energy and Agriculture, current biofuel production reduces carbon emissions by 39 to 43% compared to gasoline. 9 out of 10 cars on the road today are approved to use a 15% blend of biofuel. Today you're going to hear from many who support this initiative, and you will likely hear from those who oppose the mandate. Concerns are likely to be raised, and we will be addressing those. This coming Thursday, there will be a meeting of all the stakeholders who will work to address the concerns. They will work to also find consensus so that we can move this bill forward. So this bill will next go to the Commerce Committee. We will have more discussion along those lines. But today I'm happy to bring this forward to the Agriculture Committee, and I will ask for your support. So I'd like to bring testifiers down now to speak to this bill.
Go for it. First testifier is Chairman Brian Thalman. State your name and continue with your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brian Thalman. I currently serve as chairman of the board for the Minnesota Corn Growers Association. I am here today on behalf of Minnesota Corn and our nearly 7,000 members to support House File 3699. Thank you, Chair Poppe, for bringing this bill forward. We are here today talking about increased usage of a product made from the amazing corn kernel. In addition to the ethanol made from the starch, that corn kernel also produces highly valued dry distillers grains and corn oil, all at the same time from the same kernel of corn. In addition, the corn field where this kernel was grown also benefits from the production and return of 10 tons per acre of stalks, leaves and roots to the soil, building the soil's organic matter for future generations. Our family is a shareholder in Heartland Corn Products in Winthrop, Minnesota, and I have served on the board of directors for the past 15 years. I have witnessed firsthand the continuing evolution in productive capacity, efficiency gains, and product opportunities, all from this, again, amazing corn kernel. I am so excited about the benefits I have mentioned, but increasing ethanol usage is so much more than this. The ethanol industry is crucial to not only farmers' economic vitality, but to our entire state as well. Ethanol provides multiple benefits to Minnesota's economy, consumers, and communities. Ethanol is a cleaner burning fuel that helps to improve air quality by reducing particulate emissions and has lower carbon emissions compared to gasoline. Increased ethanol blends provide benefits to our entire state. Minnesota has long been a national leader in biofuels policy. We were the first state to require ethanol blended fuels starting back in 1997, and we have made additional strides since then. Now that the federal government has lifted the artificial barrier to year-round sales of 15% biofuel blends, it's time for Minnesota to once again lead and be the first state to adopt a 15% statewide biofuel standard. Some may ask if our state has sufficient production of ethanol to meet this 15% standard. Yes, we do. After the standard is enacted, we will still be exporting over two-thirds of the ethanol we produce in this state to customers beyond our state's borders. The corn is already being produced in Minnesota, so no additional production is necessary. The time is right. The time is now. We can do this. I look forward to seeing it move forward. Appreciate your time. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Chairman. Before we continue with testimony, I just want to take a moment to welcome the St. Peter High School students who are here today as well. So thank you for being here today. And Chair Poppe, continue with your calling witnesses.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Thalman. Eric Osman is the next testifier.
Good morning. This may not be quite the etiquette, but I do have a handout here that might enlighten the conversation a little bit.
She'll get it right here. She can take it.
Again, my name is Eric Osman. I'm the general manager at Bush Mills Ethanol, Inc. in Atwater, Minnesota. And guess what? I'm a proponent for this bill. So as we wait to get this passed around, I think it's fitting that Minnesota can laud itself as being a biofuel leader. It has been, particularly decades ago. Unfortunately, it's my lot in life to be Mr. Reality as well. And so what I've passed around here is a couple of charts produced by the pro-exporter company. I do have more, but they're circling the other way, I believe. So what I'm sending out here again are two charts, keeping it simple. And one is corn exports as a percent of production. In other words, what you're seeing here is a ratio of what states produce for corn and what they ship out of the state to other destinations. And what we can notice here, that Minnesota, with the large circle, 46% of the corn leaves the state. There was a term once called colonialism, in which a country or a place would strip the raw materials from one region and benefit from that by creating more wealth for themselves through value added, creating something of more value than the raw material. So in Minnesota, when it comes to corn, what do we see here? We have neighboring states that are using more of their corn in-house, more payrolls, more taxes, more wealth is generated. The next one I wanted to show you, if you turn the page, is also a ratio. And this is dry mill ethanol corn use compared with the production of corn in the state. So Minnesota is using roughly, 29% of its corn crop for ethanol. You know, take a look at our neighbors, the Dakotas, even Wisconsin, Iowa certainly. So the other reminder is that Bush Mills Ethanol is one of 19 ethanol plants in this state. A few years ago, I would have said we were one of 22 plants. The state has lost three. And at the rate things continue to go, there could be a few other losses. Bush Mills, fortunately, will not be one of those. We have taken the time and effort to expand, lower carbon index, increase efficiency. But as we, take a look at this proposal in front of you, this might be, a little bit of reality to show where Minnesota sits compared to its neighbors when it comes to biofuels. And I'll keep it short and succinct at that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So next we have, I think, Stu Laurie is on the list.
Please state your name and continue with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Brand and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Stu Laurie. I'm the Government Relations Director for Minnesota Farmers Union. And I want to thank Chair Poppy for bringing this bill forward. On behalf of MFU, I'd like to express our strong support. We've long supported biofuels as an organization, but our members passed a strong resolution in support of this specific move this last fall at our state convention. And when I think about that conversation at convention and those leading up to it across the summer, our members were really interested in Minnesota being the first state to adopt a higher blend standard in accordance with the new federal rules for two main reasons. First, I think they're really interested in those improved Minnesota markets and those value-added opportunities. In agriculture, we really need certainty right now, and using those products and improving the markets right here in Minnesota is one important way to do that. And second, members really see biofuels as one of the key ways that they can make an impact on climate change and lowering the carbon intensity of our transportation sector, the way that increasing our blend rates would do is one way that they can have an impact and be part of that conversation. So You know, this will improve, you know, certainty and give certainty to farmers at a time when they really need it, and give them an opportunity to lower the carbon intensity of our transportation system at a time when we really need to do that as well. So thank you so much, and I look forward to getting some notes from the FFA students on my testimony today. I'd appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
There will be additional testifiers, I'm sure, throughout the time here, but Aaron Roth is the next one that's listed, that I have listed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name's Aaron Roth. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota-Wisconsin Petroleum Council, which is part of the American Petroleum Institute based in Washington, D.C., and I will be brief. I'm not here to talk against the use of ethanol in fuel. We are the number one purchaser of ethanol, my industry is, and some of the companies that API members own or are part owners of ethanol plants. I'm here to speak against mandating E15 for a number of reasons. Number one, it's anti-consumer choice. We believe, based upon already in the marketplace, there are some 330 retail locations already selling E15, but many of those market it as 88 octane. So the confusion at the pumps is people don't know that they're buying E15, even though there's a small label on the pump. So we think, you know, E15, if it's going to move forward, should be market-based and not mandated. One other point is, you know, when you blend E15, it's got 50% more ethanol. Well, you lose fuel economy with additional ethanol from 10% to 15%. So people find they'll be refueling more often. 70% of the manufactured vehicles were not made, that are on the road today, were not made to use E15, even though EPA says vehicles 2001 and newer can use it. For instance, Ford did not introduce a vehicle that could use E15 until 2011. So that creates more confusion in the marketplace. We're really concerned. I'm from northern Minnesota. Representative Eklund, good friend. I'm from Grand Rapids originally. You know, we like our small engines, whether it's a chainsaw, whether it's our ATV, whether it's our snowmobile. And those engines are not warrantied above E10. And so there is a real problem with people misfueling. And there's no liability protection for my companies, because if somebody has a problem with their Harley and it seizes up because they misfueled, who are they going to go after? Certainly maybe the marketer, but if it says mobile on the marquee, my companies will be probably sued. The other problematic part of this bill is it only allows one E10 pump. And especially in greater Minnesota, there are a lot of legacy vehicles that are 2000 and older. And a lot of small communities, I used in the Senate, Pengilly, Minnesota, which is near Grand Rapids, they have two little gas stations. So you may force people to go 30 miles, you know, away to get E10, or they're going to fuel with non-oxygenated premium, which is generally 20 to 40 cents more per gallon. So the other problem, I know the marketers are going to talk about compatibility with pumps and equipment that could be damaged because of the corrosiveness and not compliant with EPA, the cost to replace those equipment. But certainly there's so many issues here. The governor just is appointing his biofuels task force to look at some of these issues over the interim, and our hope is that, you know, you set aside this bill, let the task force do its work so that we can vet all these issues, and then, you know, they will come back with a recommendation at the end of the year. So with that, thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Next on the list is Rick Dean. State your name and please continue with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Rick Dean. I am the Vice President of the Minnesota Petroleum Marketers Association and also a fourth generation business owner of Dean Oil Company located in Ramsey, Minnesota. Our association is a 500 multi-generational family businesses and farm co-ops that provide fuel needs to residential homes, businesses, and farms across all parts of Minnesota. Our members are also operators and owners of the majority of the 2,000 convenience stores found in our state. The Minnesota Petroleum Marketers and its members are proud providers of biofuels that energize Minnesota. We support the goal of expanding the availability and use of biofuel blends. And with that goal in mind, our association has some concerns with this recent legislation. I would like to describe four of them. First would be the availability of E15. Availability of E15 must meet current level of E10 availability found readily at all of the terminals across the state of Minnesota to ensure no interruption in fuel provided to the public and our customers. Also, in line with the E15 availability, ethanol produced in Minnesota must be at the capacity to meet the new increased biofuel demand. It is our hope that this new demand directly support the Minnesota farmers. Our second concern is the serious compatibility issue with our underground storage tank systems related to the storage and sale of biofuel blends of greater than 10% ethanol. The leading cause for the lack of E15 available across our state right now is the fact that 85% of our members' underground storage tank infrastructure is incompatible with biofuel blends greater than 10% ethanol. One solution to this compatibility problem is to do exactly as this bill says, state that underground storage tank systems that are currently compatible with 10% ethanol are automatically compatible with E15. Basically, E15 then would be equal to E10, thus drawing a new line in the sand for conventional biofuels. But there are also some serious issues. We have some concerns regarding this language, because currently numerous government agencies require proof of compatibility with our systems and the products we sell, thus putting us in conflict in violation with the EPA, the MPCA, the Petro Fund, and the Minnesota State Fire Marshal. A resolution must be worked out with these government agencies on another solution or address our compatibility issues and requirements before the E15 mandate can be put into force. Third is the concern with the potential increased risk to our underground storage tank systems and releases with the higher use and storage of biofuel blends. We ask to protect our members' properties, their businesses, and their legacies for the next generation. This potential increase in liability must be addressed and protections put in place for our members. And finally, in regards to the requirements of the fuel offerings, due to the infrastructure system designs and a limited number of tanks and constraints with the product offering for each site will be very unique. Some sites will be able to offer E10 along with the E15, but others will not. So some retailers, it will be a business decision, basically, on products to offer for sale beyond E15. So we're asking for the exemption for E10 should mirror the exemption allowed currently for non-oxy premium, including limiting the use of E10 for vehicles 2001 or older, with no requirements on if or to what degree the product is offered for sale at a retail site. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for your time. I'd be happy to field any questions related to any of my points of concern.
And members, we're going to hold questions until after all the testifiers are done, but we're keeping a list, so raise your hand and we'll make sure you get on the list, okay? I know we've got a couple of people already. Thank you very much for your testimony. Now, next is Mike O'Brien. Do you want to come down to the podium and state your name and continue with your testimony?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Mike O'Brien. I'm Vice President of Market Development for Growth Energy. For those of you not familiar with Growth Energy, we are the nation's largest biofuel advocacy organization. We represent about two-thirds of the ethanol production in the United States. And my role specifically is of a commercial nature. I am responsible for the commercial build-out of E15 nationwide. Of the 2,000 retail sites selling E15 today, I've been directly involved with 1,600 of those locations. For what it's worth, I'm based here in Lakeville, Minnesota, so I'm a Minnesota native and travel around the United States. And I've worked with single store owners that are third and fourth generation that have been selling products since the 1950s all the way up to 12 of the largest retail chains in the United States. So I've been doing this work for about 7 years, and so I've kind of seen the very first beginning of E15 up into where it's at today. So appreciate your support on E15. Minnesota's been a tremendous state on developing this product for us. So I just wanted to point out a few things about that growth that we're seeing. The reason being is retailers recognize that consumers like this product once it's put in place in front of them. And there's some compelling reasons for it from a consumer standpoint. When they pull up to the pump, they're saving anywhere from 2 to 10 cents a gallon on E15, depending on the market conditions. After they put it in, they find the performance of the product is good. Department of Energy has validated that there is no loss in performance with E15 versus other grades of fuel. That includes mileage. There is no statistical difference between E15 and any other grade of fuel. They're also like the fact that it's a cleaner burning product. In fact, I was looking at the sales data today, and we have sold enough E15 in this country to drive 13 billion miles by consumers without any issues whatsoever of any kind with vehicles, small engines, boats, anything. There's been nothing that has happened with this product. But I frequently have to work with retailers. There's a lot of misunderstandings about the product and the rules associated with it, and one does have to do with compatibility. And so to understand compatibility equipment specifically, the EPA has guidelines. And those guidelines are twofold. One is the equipment that stores and dispenses the product must have a UL certification, or, and this is important, this is the part that's frequently left out or not understood, or carry a manufacturer warranty. That's an important distinction, and I'll read a finding from the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, which is part of the Department of Energy, which mirrors the experience we've had with the 1,600 locations I mentioned. It is often stated that tanks cannot be used to store E15, but this assumption is incorrect as the majority of installed tanks can store blends above E10. For many decades, underground storage tank manufacturers approved their tanks for blends up to E100. For example, all steel tanks and double-walled fiberglass tanks since the year 1990 carry warranties for their products. You'll find similar language with the Steel Institute and all of the manufacturer warranty information in the Petroleum Equipment Institute. So we're frequently engaged with finding that information for retailers and find that we do have a lot of compatibility out there for E15. Above ground, you've got dispensers. Gilbarco and Wayne are the two major manufacturers. They've got well over 90% market share between the two of them. Both of those companies also have warranties in place for their equipment as well. So the other piece that we hear about from time to time is concern over retail liability. Growing up, my father was an insurance underwriter. The insurance companies are the experts on liability. So when this first came up, I contacted 9 of the largest liability underwriters in the United States for retailers. The largest is based in Faribault, Minnesota, Federated Insurance. They have stated that retailers selling E15 carry no more increased liability than diesel, which is commonly sold. They do point out that the retailer must have the required EPA sticker. They must follow the EPA guidelines. But after they reviewed all of their policies, they said there was no need to single out E15 or change their policies because it carries full coverage for them. So So they felt that the liability for the retailer himself was pretty low. On top of that, I mentioned the 12 large retailers we work with. Many of them have gasoline warranties. Sheets, QT, Quick Trip, Thornton's, Racetrack, they've been selling this product for years. They've had millions and millions of transactions with consumers. Not a single reported incident on those warranties or those guarantees, and they do get complaints, but not a single one towards E15 at this point. So just in conclusion, when we have E15 in the marketplace, it's alongside the other grades of fuel. Consumers select this fuel. Sales rates of it at any given location can be as high as 50%, even at 60% at times, depending on the situation. Consumers buy the product. They keep coming back to it. That's why that 13 billion miles is growing. In fact, just 2 months ago, that was 12 billion miles, to give you an indication of the momentum that's building behind E15. So thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Next, I'd like to call up Deputy Commissioner Andrea Vogel. State your name and begin.
Absolutely. Good morning. Thank you so much. My name is Andrea Vobel. I serve as Deputy Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Thank you so much for having me this morning. I will keep it brief. I'm just up here to voice our support from the administration for an E15 standard. As you know, Governor Walz has been a staunch supporter of biofuels in his long career. He does serve as the vice chair of the governor's biofuels coalition, and then he did stand up the governor's council on biofuels. So we absolutely see it as something that's good for the environment and rural communities. Some of our sister agencies have a few questions, and we are working with the stakeholders and authors to work those out, but we look forward and are committed to moving this forward.
Thank you very much. Last up on my list is Kevin Papp from the Minnesota Farmers Union, or Farmers Bureau, Farm Bureau.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Kevin Papp. I'm president of Minnesota Farm Bureau. We're the largest farm organization in the state of Minnesota with nearly 30,000 members. We've got members in every county. We're organized in 78 county or regional farm bureaus. You know, as a fourth generation farmer, anything we can do to add value is good. And it just seems a little unique that as Farm Bureau, we're last on the list on a topic that we're typically always first on in Minnesota. Whether it's ethanol, whether it's biodiesel, I had the honor to serve on the biodiesel task force. As your report was already given, represent Minnesota Farm Bureau on the biofuels task force, and are excited to hear from the administration, the Department of Transportation, how important biofuels will be as we move forward on that. Most everything's been said, so I just want to review just five quick things. Number one, it's ethanol biofuels is good for farmers. It adds value. It helps us add value, but we also need to remember we don't use the whole kernel for ethanol, just part of that. We've got value as well with our co-products and things like that. It's good for the farmers, but number two, more importantly, it's good for our rural citizens, for our main streets. It's all about jobs, and that's so important, and we've already heard about losing ethanol plants, losing jobs in Minnesota. But number three, it's not necessarily just about farmers in those rural communities. It's good for all Minnesotans. It makes fuel cheaper. It's a renewable source that helps make fuel cheaper, and that's such an important thing. And not very often do we get something that's cheaper that is better. And it is better because it's higher octane. And that's so important that we think about that, having that value. And the fifth one, and maybe the most important, maybe not for me as a fourth generation farmer, but I've got the fifth generation farmer a half a mile down the road from me. And we've also got the sixth generation farmer, hopefully grandson. And as we look at, if we're going to do things that are climate smart, this is certainly has to be part of that solution. And we've got to think about what is the future of Minnesota, whether it's farmers, rural communities, but all of Minnesota. Let's use this as an important tool as we move forward and be climate smart as we talk about emissions and global greenhouse gases and things like that. So my only ask is on behalf of Minnesota Farm Bureau, even though that we're testifying last on the list, we'd like to keep Minnesota first on the list as we talk about biofuels. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. President of the Minnesota Farm Bureau. That concludes all the folks that I have on my list. Are there any other members of the audience who wish to testify for or against the bill today? Okay, seeing none, we will go on to member questions. First on the list is Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to ask a question of Mr. Dean, Petroleum Marketers. He could stop back up.
And if anybody had testified, because there might be some questions, if you could move closer to the table there for expediency.
Yes, sir. Go ahead, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
Mr. Dean, I appreciated your testimony. I understand the concern. Obviously, you're an important part of making something like this work in Minnesota. My question involves your comment about the concern about the availability of E15. Since ethanol can't be transported through a pipeline, it's got to be taken to the terminal, I assume, by transport load, and it's blended at the terminal. So why would it be an issue blending E15 more so than blending E10?
Mr. Dean, go ahead.
I can't speak to that. All I can speak to is currently, as it stands right now, I believe it's only one rack in the state of Minnesota that offers E15 for sale as a blended product. And so that's what we're asking is that it's offered just as E10 right now. E10 is offered blended all over the state. So that's all we're saying is we just need to make sure that's part of the conversation, is that the availability of E15 is where E10 is right now.
Mr. Representative Anderson, do you have a follow-up?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand that concern, and certainly as this would move forward, I would hope that we would be working, and the committee is working on making this rollout as widespread as possible. It would have to be rolled out, as you say, statewide to make this work. And I had a question for Mr. Roth about the losing economy, if he could stop down. Mr. Roth, I've used E15 in my car since whenever it became available, and not doing anything scientific, but I don't see any loss in economy. You mentioned that would happen with E15. Do you have any statistics that would show that, or where did you get that statement?
Mr. Roth, may I answer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, first, could I tag on the last terminal question, because it is a sizable cost to retrofit a terminal to inject blend, to be able to inject blend E15, and the one terminal, I believe, is in Roseville that does it. So there is an added cost to some of my members if we're moving in that direction, not just with the retail issues. But in terms of miles per gallon, that comes from our API staff, and I can get that information. I've been told it depends on the manufacturer. It can be anywhere from 2 to 5%, depending on the vehicles, what I've been told. But I will follow up with the committee with that.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks. One final comment. I read a lot about this issue, and what I've read is that there's kind of a sweet spot of E25 where we would get the best economy and the best overall use of ethanol. So I'm interested to see those numbers, but I personally don't see any loss in economy or mileage with E15. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Hamilton is next on our list.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My questions can direct both to Representative Dean, Mr. Dean and Mr. Roth. I want to know, how have you been able to manage with the availability, compatibility, the increased risk of storage, fuel offerings, et cetera, your concerns? How have you been able to manage with the E10?
Well, right now,
Mr.
it's...
Dean, go ahead.
Oh, sorry, Mr. Chairman. Right now, you all are listing for our equipment that's been installed for the last 20 or 30 years is listed as you all listed for E10 ethanol. Okay? So that's what our concern is this is 15% ethanol. And that is, you know, not listed. That we're concerned about manufacturer warranties. We're concerned about how the federal EPA would view that. There's a release on a site currently, as long as we follow the rules and we're storing product that the site, as you all listed for, we can receive 90% of our funds from the Minnesota Petro Fund when we apply for a grant if there's a cleanup or something has taken place on that site. If we're storing products that aren't UL listed, don't meet our UL listing, then as owner of that property, we'll be responsible 100% for that cleanup. So.
Representative Hamilton.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And Mr. Dean, is it safe to say that you've been able to accommodate what that entailed when the state went to E10?
Yeah, yeah. Mr. Dean? Excuse me, sorry, Mr. Chairman. I guess I don't understand exactly what you mean.
Well, here, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll just end it like this. Here's my, I've been here for a while, and I've heard the exact same concerns back when ethanol was originally discussed, when we went to E10, the exact same concerns, and yet we collectively have been able to address those concerns and make it work. And that's my point here today. I believe that, once again, collectively, we'll be able to step up and meet these needs because we've done it in the past. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next on our list is Representative Tabke.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And this is a question for Chair Poppy or whoever is best to address it. So I am fully in favor of the bill and fully in favor of increasing the biofuel content. And my question specifically is on lines 2.8 through 2.15 in the bill. And with this, and just so I give a little context, is I fully support ethanol conventional biofuels, but also think that we should be using setting up that market to bridge toward additional cellulosic ethanol and the future of where ethanol can go for perennial crops and different things like that. So what is the necessity of part C in there for the requiring 90% in 2020 and reducing that each year? Why is that an important part of the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Tabke, and I'm just going to ask that I have someone come to assist me at this point.
And if you could state your name and continue.
Good morning, Amanda Billick, Policy Director for the Minnesota Corn Growers, and Representative Tabke and Mr. Chair, in response to your question. So the bill does allow, and the statute was amended in 2013, for other types of fuels that qualify under the Federal Renewable Fuel Standard for advanced and cellulosic. This section, since those fuels are not currently being produced at a commercial level, would ensure that corn ethanol or conventional biofuel meets that now and then ramps it down into the future to all those other fuels as they come online.
Representative Tabke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That answers my question, and I have already asked Ms. Billick about that issue, so I'm glad that you were able to answer it publicly for us. Thank you.
Next on the list, Representative Miller.
Thank you. I'm going to take this microphone. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. I have a quick question and then a brief thought. So my quick question is to the author, Chair Poppy. In this, it redefines, and I'm just curious to get this clarification, it redefines ethanol as biofuel, which I see we're updating a lot of legislation throughout this year in the legislature on kind of making things. But I'm just wondering if there is a different, or if it's just synonymous, we're just updating it. So does biofuel include things other than ethanol? I'm just curious if you could clarify that.
Chair Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Miller. Biofuel is kind of the overall umbrella term that's being used. So sometimes we look at other blends and other kinds of things that would be a part of biofuel. So ethanol would be one, biobutanol. The other things that we have done in the past, and most recently I know we did something in 2013 that kind of expanded that as well on the biobutanol kind of front, and so I would say it's kind of the overall category.
Okay, Mr. Chair. Representative Miller. I have a quick follow-up with that, then my brief statement. There isn't even a question to this. I get it. But my concern with the way I read this bill is it will say that 15% biofuel, and that may raise questions in the future. So just as a committee, as that comes forward, we need to be cautious about that. I don't know of anything other than ethanol that's being blended in gasoline, and if it is, it probably makes sense. But then some of the concerns of the industry come in again. Is there equipment designed for it and things like that? So more of a cautious thing there. So I guess no question. Mr. Chair, I would like to make a brief comment on this. I've listened to all the testimony, and I first want to say that I fully support E15. I hope that every vehicle we use can use E15, even up to, I think Representative Anderson said, E25 safely, effectively, because more ethanol being sold out of Minnesota is a good thing. I have some ethanol plants in my district. I have more just outside my district. Those are good for my area. I have plenty of corn growers. But here's my concern. I like about everything in this bill. I think what we do is we need to make sure as best as possible as a legislature we can build access to E15, that we can enable it so that it improves. But I really don't like the word mandate. And I have a big problem with that, because what mandate does is it ends up effectively pitting one group against another. And that's what we heard here today. I just jotted a couple industries, and this is not exhaustive, but it's not just corn growers that's going to be affected by this and the ethanol plants. It's trucking, it's fuel providers, gas stations, recreational vehicles. There's lots of other stakeholders that are in this that this is going to, they're saying, is going to be challenging for them. Now, as we move forward, like we did with E10, although I have a small engines guy who tells me not to even use E10 on my small engines to this day, but as we move from E10 into E15, I think we can address some of these issues, except for when we say it's going to be mandated and here's the guideline. So I have a real concern with that, but here's the final comment that I want to make to that. I'm thankful, Representative or Chair Poppy, that the stakeholders are going to get together this Thursday and figure something out. I'm thankful that the governor is putting something together. I would say for every industry person in this room, not just corn, ethanol, but also the people who represent petroleum and these other people, get this thing figured out. Because what happens is what you're seeing here today. If we get frustrated enough, government starts telling you what to do, okay? And so I understand why this bill has come forward. I don't like that there's a mandate, but we need to figure this out, because I am a supporter of ethanol. I think it should be and can be used in fuels. I think that's been proven out over time. And I hope we can come to some level of solution here to where at least the stakeholders are satisfied that at least something was addressed. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple questions. Do I, Representative Poppy, Chair Poppy, these recommendations are coming from the governor's office, but there's discussion happening on Thursday?
Chair Poppy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Keel. This is a bill that is the corn growers are supportive of, and so it's coming forward through that. The governor is supportive of moving toward the mandate of the 15%. Actually, he'd like to see us move faster and quicker toward 30% by 2025. So this is kind of just moving along those lines. But this Thursday there is a stakeholders meeting that's going to be meeting to address, you know, the concerns. There are certainly infrastructure concerns, or there are, is the proof of compatibility and things like that. So I know that those are on the table to be discussed, and Thursday that meeting will be happening.
Okay.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then I would understand that when you say stakeholders, that all will be involved in ironing out the questions and the concerns.
Chair Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Keel. From my understanding, that is the case.
Okay. Can I?
Representative Keel.
Thank you. The conversation in the language in 2.21 to 2.23 talks about ethanol replaces it with conventional biofuel. Now, I think I understood this, but this is going to refer to all kinds of different biofuels? Is that the intent?
Chair Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I'm incorrect in this response, I'll ask for some support. But I would say conventional biofuel is the reference now to ethanol. But as we're talking about general biofuels, that's kind of more of an expansive term. But the conventional biofuel is what we have typically been known as ethanol.
Okay.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. I'm just wondering, 2.20 removes the requirement that the waiver applies to all motor vehicles, regardless of the model year. Are we going to see a potential confusion among the the consumers? I was going to say commissioners. Confusion among the consumers and the warranty issues that have been discussed that are not manufactured to use E15.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Keel. I can't speak necessarily to the confusion that consumers may have when they go to the pump and would see this, but again, that is something we're trying to, and over the course of the last few years, I know that there's been a pretty strong effort to encourage the use of E15 and to understand the value of it and the reason why. I drive an older car. It's not as old as 2001, but it's an older car. And so to be able to use that, we just need to sometimes re-educate the public about, and we have pretty strong consumers these days who are looking at reading labels and understanding things. So this is just a part of that. We will continue to educate people so that they understand the value of it and the purpose, and hopefully would be able to use it.
Representative Keel, and I just wanted to point out I got one more person on the list, and we have to vote on this, and I want to get the train on time. So
I understand that entirely. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your indulgence. I would express my concern that we make sure that all parties are where they need to be before we roll this out. I too have a little bit of concern about mandates. I want to say that the market will encourage people to use ethanol, but it's pretty rural in some areas. I don't want to have a car stuck on the road and no phone that works. So and I after working on biodiesel, I appreciate the use of ag products and what we're doing, but I want to make sure that it works for people and in their engines. So thank you.
Last question, Representative Anderson.
Thanks again, Mr. Chair. Well, I would just remind all of us that this bill does not contain any timeline, so I think it would be moved ahead when it works, and I appreciate the parties getting together to work on coming up to standards. As Mr. Pat mentioned, this is good for Minnesota. It's good for farmers. Ethanol plants need some additional demand right now because of politics, federal politics and such. Ethanol is not real profitable right now, and we need the additional gallons that this would produce. And I would like to ask if somebody could come up with numbers for the next meeting that using current mileage figures and such, how much additional ethanol would be required to fulfill this jump from E10 to E15. And then one last thing, on my way in yesterday morning, head on the rural radio program, and the feds just announced Monday that they're coming out with a $100 million infrastructure program for this very thing. So I think the timing of this is very good. They're going to roll out their specifications this spring. So there's going to be more money available to help our service stations if they have to upgrade tanks or pumps, whatever. And the timing, I think, is good with that program coupled with this bill by Chair Poppy. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you very much. Representative Poppy, would you like to renew your motion?
Yes, and before I do that, let me just reiterate a couple of things. Minnesota currently produces 1.27 billion gallons of ethanol each year, approximately 25% of current production is consumed in state, with the other 75% exported. So we have it here, and we can use it here. And as Representative Anderson mentioned, yes, there is federal dollars now available for infrastructure concerns, and we've heard about some of those concerns. So hopefully we can capture federal dollars to be able to address that. And I understand the concerns that people have about having a mandate, but this is, the time does seem right, and Minnesota has been a leader, and we continue to want to push ourselves forward like that. This Thursday, there will be a meeting of stakeholders, and if you have concerns, Representative Keel, I don't know if there are any additional stakeholders that you thought of that maybe should be included. I think that you know, the people who are doing that meeting are interested in hearing from everybody and trying to come up with a consensus. So we do want to move this forward. This bill is going to Commerce Committee next. It does add value and provide certainty to farmers and producers, and so I do ask for your support as we move this bill forward. So I would renew my motion that House File 3699 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Commerce.
Okay. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All those opposed, nay. The motion prevails. House File 3699 is on its way to the Commerce Committee. Thank you very much, members. Meeting adjourned, but before I do that, I saw a couple of vote stickers. Thanks for doing that, and just a reminder that the polls are still open. Meeting adjourned.